Hello, this is Peter Williams on Reality Check Radio. This past Anzac Day, I was invited to be the guest speaker at the Anzac Day service at Waikaka in northern Southland, or as the locals call it, Waikaka. This is what I said there. Thank you for the invitation to be here this morning. It's a pleasure and a privilege. Speaking at an Anzac Day service in a small rural Southland village takes me back to my childhood. That's because between the ages of 6 and 8, and that was just over 60 years ago, my family lived at Kennington. My father was a schoolteacher, born in November of 1925, so too young just for active military service. In 1960, he became the principal of the then two-teacher village school at Kennington, which has long since closed down. But those of you who have ever been to Kennington or even driven through it on the way to someplace else like Rimu or Gorge Road or Fort Rose will know that the most famous landmark in Kennington is the old school's War Memorial Gates. I remember as a child being fascinated by them, even then at such a young age, thinking to myself, why such an ornate, attractive, striking structure, which had obviously taken weeks of work with the engraving of all those names in the marble, would be built in a small and insignificant village like Kennington. I still don't know the answer to that question, but I imagine it has something to do with the pain the community would have felt having some of their number killed on the battlefields of lands so far away. I don't know who the instigator of the Memorial Gates project was or who paid for them, but whoever was responsible has done the little village proud for nearly 100 years. The gates actually feature on the government's official history website, and there are numerous photos of them. For the 3 years or so that we lived at Kennington, I walked through those gates on my way into school every day, and then as well on my way to the playing fields on the other side of the road. And for the two Anzac days that we lived in Kennington, I can still remember as a child going to the service, like this one, to pay tribute to the men of the village whose names were engraved on those gates and whose siblings and children still lived in the village. Remember, this would have been a little more than 15 years after the end of World War II. The gates were originally built in 1927. They were modified and then expanded after the Second World War. Engraved in the marble are the names of all those from the district who served in both wars, and there are separate plaques to commemorate those who died in the wars. There's also another separate plaque for that famous son of Southland, James Hargest. He was wounded at Gallipoli and on his return home became a farmer and then a National Party Member of Parliament in the 1930s before he went back to war again. He rose to the rank of brigadier in World War II before he was killed in France at the Battle of Normandy in August of 1944. He had a son, Geoffrey, who was killed in action at Monte Cassino 5 months before his father, and whose name is also inscribed on that marble plaque, along with that of another son, Peter Hargest, who tragically later died in the Malayan emergency in 1952. The family farmed at Rakahuka, only a few kilometres from Kennington, and while the Hargest children probably went to primary school at either Roslyn Bush or Myros Bush, the proximity to Kennington must have been enough for the Kennington gates to have a special memorial plaque just for the Hargest family. But think of the impact on Mrs. Hargest, Marie, whom James had married at the end of World War I when she was working as a New Zealand nurse in England. They had 4 children. But in the space of 8 years, Mrs. Hargest, Marie, lost her husband and 2 sons, all killed in military action. Sadly, that's a story repeated too often up and down New Zealand during the 2 world wars. Across both conflicts, more than 28,000 of our countrymen lost their lives. There have, of course, been many changes in Kennington since we lived there. The Four Square store operated by the Ramseys doesn't exist. The wooden school buildings themselves are long gone. There's been a new church built and a few new houses. But the War Memorial Gates are still there, standing proud. And I'm glad they are. I've been back through the village a few times over the years. And especially when I'm travelling by myself, I like to stop at those gates and remember not just the days of a happy childhood in the Southland countryside of the early 1960s, but I also think of the young men from the area who went off to war and whose names are engraved in those gates. And I ask myself, why did they go? Did they really want to go? Did they know what they were fighting for? As a child and as a young teenager, I knew a World War I veteran. He was married to my grandmother for the last 10 years of his life. I knew him as Uncle Fred from when I was about five. His name was Fred Bucock. He came from Annat, a dot on the map on the Canterbury Plains. He was born in 1893, and after army training in Canterbury, he left New Zealand on April the 17th, 1915, on one of three HMNZTs, His Majesty's New Zealand troop ships, that sailed from Wellington that day. By not leaving until the middle of April, he wasn't at Gallipoli for the landings on the morning of the 25th, but he did serve on the peninsula from August of that year till the end of the disastrous campaign early in 1916. He never held high rank on the army roll. He's listed in the rank column among the privates and the troopers and the riflemen as a driver in the Army Service Corps. His brother James was a corporal in the Canterbury Mounted Rifles. From what I can glean from family members in recent years, Uncle Fred then moved with his colleagues from Gallipoli west across the Mediterranean to the Western Front and the awful battles on the fields of France and Belgium. I don't know exactly where he served. I wish now I'd asked him more about those times when he was alive. But I was 15 when he died, and I never found it appropriate or comfortable to pry into someone's war history, especially when he had been seriously injured. Because what I do know is that sometime, and I think it was in 1917, he suffered an horrendous injury and had his right forearm damaged so badly it required amputation. He was taken to an army hospital in England where he recuperated for over a year before returning to New Zealand in 1919. He had a crude prosthetic brace attached to his arm just below his right elbow. And from that brace, you could click in other attachments, the weirdest one of all being a creepy wooden hand enclosed in a brown glove, which had a screw to which you attached a knife or a spoon at mealtime. I do remember him showing us a metal cigarette box, which he kept as a memento, and which had a significant dent in it. It saved his life because it was in his breast pocket and acted as a body armor when a bullet hit him. When he came back from the war, he married, and in the 1920s, he owned a neighborhood shop. But for whatever reason, that business didn't work out. He either could not or would not work again. So for about 40 years, his son told me later, his only source of income was the war pension. According to the records, his injury and disability meant he was awarded 30 shillings a week in 1920, an amount that was surely increased over time as he married and had two sons of his own before being widowed and subsequently marrying my divorced grandmother 10 years later. But as I've grown to adulthood and been very fortunate to work in an industry that I've mostly enjoyed for pretty close to 50 years, I sometimes think, how would you feel about your purpose in life if you were unable to work because of injury and disability, both physical and mental, suffered in a war that was not your country's war? So why were the young New Zealand men of 1914 so enthusiastic about going to battle? At the risk of reading the minds of young men from more than a century ago, I suspect there were two reasons. One, it was a huge adventure. A trip to the other side of the world in those days was something only the really wealthy could afford. And two, there existed in the minds of many young men of the time a sense of duty to king and country. Hargest himself said, despite his lack of education, that while working on his father's farm in the Hokanui's, he dreamed of serving the mighty British Empire. No doubt the seeds of that thinking had been sown during his limited primary school education, which goes to show that indoctrination of our children is not a new thing. Did these young men really want to go? Early on in World War I, the answer would surely have been yes. The original Anzacs of 1915 were all volunteers. Hargest was a volunteer, so was my Uncle Fred. But the number of casualties in Gallipoli and on the Western Front and the subsequent drop-off in the voluntary enrolments meant that conscription was introduced in 1916. It sounds like a time in New Zealand history which might not have been very pleasant. As reports came back about the horrific slaughter of New Zealand youth at Gallipoli and then on the fields of Belgium and northern France on the Western Front, thousands of military-age men decided they did not want to go to war. But the government, under Prime Minister William Massey, was hard-nosed. Those who objected to going to war were hunted down. Eventually, 286 men were sent to jail as conscientious objectors. One of them was a future Prime Minister, Peter Fraser. Another 2,320 men were labelled military defaulters, and they were deprived of civil rights for 10 years. That meant they couldn't have a job in the public service or with a local council. They couldn't vote in general or local elections, and they couldn't be an MP or a councillor. Over 100 years later, the names of those 2,320 men are still published online. What must their descendants think? Even from the distance of more than 100 years, I find the denial of those basic human rights, like having a job of your choice and being able to vote, quite repugnant, especially when the so-called crime was refusing to fight another nation's war. But in the end, the volunteers completely outnumbered the conscripted by a ratio of 4-1. The official number of New Zealand servicemen who went overseas in World War I was 98,950, and that was 9% of the New Zealand population of the time. But that leads to the next question I posed. What were these men actually fighting for? The actual causes of World War I are still debated by historians even now, but the overall theme is one of nationalism and military expansion throughout Europe because of the competing interests of Germany, Austria-Hungary, Russia, and the Ottoman Empire. Britain was worried about the potential for Germany to become all-powerful in Europe, so it resisted the expansion of Germany and went to war on mainland Europe. But even so, why did New Zealand have to become involved from the other side of the world? The answer lies in the ties of the apron strings to Mother England. 25 years later, Michael Joseph Savage, the first Labour Party Prime Minister, said of Britain, when Hitler invaded Poland starting World War II, he said, "Where she goes, we go. Where she stands, we stand." In 1914 and in 1915, the same obligation existed. It wasn't just a cultural one in this nation either. By that time, it was a nation dominated by British and Irish immigrants. It was an economic obligation as well, because they bought our produce, our meat, our wool, our butter. They paid New Zealand's way in the world. Our political leaders were unquestioning in their military support, and the majority of the population agreed. But the price we paid as a nation was appalling. 18,058 New Zealanders died in World War I, nearly 2% of the entire New Zealand population. No wonder H.G. Wells called it the war to end war. Yet, barely 20 years later, we were at it again. And once again, a generation of young New Zealand men went off to stop the military expansionism, not just of Germany and Italy, but this time too of Japan and the real threat that was therefore posed to these remote islands in the South Pacific. This time, the percentage of New Zealanders involved overseas during the 6 years of war was similar to World War I, 140,000 from a population of 1.6 million. For what it's worth, there were fewer casualties. 11,928 is the official number of New Zealand deaths in World War II, but per million of population, it was still the highest ratio in the Commonwealth. As with the 1914 to 1918 conflict, the public support for the war effort was considerable. This was despite conscription, again, conscription instigated by that old conchy, the conscientious objector himself, Peter Fraser. Just to prove that left-wing prime ministers have always been hypocrites, Fraser's coalition government oversaw the imprisonment of more than 800 Conchis in the Second World War for the so-called crime of not wanting to risk their lives in war. As well, there was strict censorship. In 1942, a Methodist minister, Ormond Burton, who was actually a decorated World War I veteran, was jailed for 2.5 years for publishing a so-called subversive document, a Christian Pacifist Society bulletin. The story of his trial makes for somber reading in the days before we had a Bill of Rights Act. The judge, Justice Archibald Blair, told the jury it was time the mouths of cranks should be shut. The sentence for such an act, publishing so-called subversive material, was in the statutes at 12 months. But the judge invoked a section of the Crimes Act and put Ormond Burton away for 2.5 years. Ormond Burton was a man ahead of his time. He maintained his pacifist beliefs even after that jail sentence and later marched against the Vietnam War. He died in 1974. So twice in 30 years we sent a generation of young men off to war to die on the battlefields of Europe and then in Asia. We have had it instilled into us over the years that these men were heroes. They died so that we may live, has been a constant catch cry on Anzac Day for most of my life. But if they died to protect freedom, then what does that say about modern-day New Zealand, a New Zealand that many of a self-appointed elite don't even want to call by its legally constituted name? Even worse, they want to take away the freedoms that distinguish a mature liberal democracy. I don't know how much the unjustified punishment dished out to the Conchis of the World Wars contributed to the drafting of the Bill of Rights Act in 1990, but in my mind, that act should be the foundation of life in New Zealand today. The freedom of thought, of conscience and opinion, freedom of association, freedom of expression, freedom of peaceful assembly, the right to vote with equal suffrage where every vote is of equal value, let alone the right to refuse to undergo medical treatment. What I've seen in the last 5 years is an erosion of those rights, an erosion of those freedoms. And as we approach what I think is a seminal election in this country's history, we should just remember what our options are. If those 28,000 New Zealanders who died in the World Wars were indeed dying for our freedom, dying so that our democracy could be protected, then let us ensure that almost 80 years after the end of the second of those global conflicts, that democracy is indeed protected. Let us ensure that James Hargest and his son Geoffrey did not die so that the value of a vote could be increased for some but not for others. Let us ensure that Fred Bucock did not have his arm blown off on the Western Front so that we lost our ability to express opinions freely and without disadvantage. Let us ensure we continue to gather at places like the Kennington Memorial Gates and here at Waikaka every April the 25th and remember what those wars were about. Let's protect democracy and let's protect freedom. Lest we forget. Thank you.